and good evening, or good morning, or good afternoon, or very early morning somewhere. You know, radio used to be simple. You actually would just broadcast locally, and eventually, you know, if you got on the Red Network or the Blue Network, you could be heard in Los Angeles if you were broadcasting from New York, or you could be heard in New York if you were in L.A. But now we have the entire planet. I mean, we are on the Dark Matter Digital Network, and we literally can reach anybody anywhere on Earth. I mean, literally anybody anywhere on Earth. So tonight, of course, is Open Lines, which I am renaming. As of tonight, Open Lines becomes Open Hailing Frequencies. That sounds vaguely familiar. And when we do that, when we open our frequencies and we connect, remember, if you say something anywhere on this planet, any one of 7 billion other people can listen to you, can hear you, can resonate with what you're saying, and something can change. The butterfly effect is in full measure on the other side of midnight. Okay, let me clean up a couple of things from last night. We had an extraordinary guest, Georgia Lambert, and she and I kind of muddled around about the Pope's itinerary. We did not know when we were talking last night if the Pope actually was going to be celebrating Mass at the National Cathedral this coming afternoon in Washington, D.C., and lo and behold, at about 4:15 p.m., he will be holding a Juniper Serra canonization Mass at the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception, which is another way of saying that we were wrong. The Pope, in fact, is conducting Mass, and you'll notice that it's set at 4:15. And if you go through the schedule, which we have listed at the top of the website tonight, everyone go to othersideofmidnight.com, click on, you know, Open Hailing Frequencies. That will take you to tonight's page. And there at the top of the page, we have a few interesting things of interest, including the current itinerary of Pope Francis' visit to the United States of America. And you'll notice that there are interesting times, like 9:15, 4:15, 9:20, 6:45, 11:15. We were talking last night, Georgia and I, about the fact that the Pope is entering, or did enter this afternoon, yesterday afternoon actually, a sacred space, which has been deliberately been built as the nation's capital at 39 degrees north latitude, which is twice 19.5. So I'm sitting here, and I'm prepping for tonight's show, and I'm thinking, what are some of the things we might want to bring up? You know, we could bring up, obviously, Iron Mountain is a topic of discussion. I'm getting quite a bit of email on Iron Mountain. People are really intrigued that this thing, which has lingered in the ether for so long, turns out to actually be real. How do we know it's real? Because last week, the President of the United States, Barack Obama, declassified some 2,500 documents from the Kennedy and Johnson years, the infamous or famous presidential daily briefs. And lo and behold, there on October 1st and October 2nd and October 4th, there are listed briefings on Iron Mountain for President Lyndon Johnson. Except, of course, if you go to the actual PDBs and look at them, the one for October 1st, the first briefing, is missing, totally, gone. And the second one for October 4th has been so extraordinarily redacted that it's just basically a blank piece of paper. Now, if Iron Mountain was just a fake, if it was a hoax, if it was just a, you know, running up the flagpole and see who salutes, as I used to say when I lived back east, why is it missing from President Johnson's daily briefings? Why was it deemed top secret, as those pages in the document on the 4th are so labeled? Food for thought. We're actually working on a full show featuring Robin and many other people to discuss Iron Mountain from many perspectives. We'll let you know when we get closer when that will be. But as part of that, we discussed the idea that there is this sacred space built in and around and through Washington, which for hundreds of years has functioned to amplify the background torsion field, and that the Pope was basically walking into this, well, flying into it. And in entering this sacred space, he is supposed to be doing certain things at certain times that correspond to certain celestial alignments. And one of the things we talked about was the recurrence in this physics, in this geometry, in the sacred space of Washington, of 19.5. So I'm watching, you know, the Pope arrive, and watching this really gorgeous Airbus land at Andrews, Joint Base Andrews, they're calling it now. It used to be Andrews Air Force Base. And I hear out of one ear Brian Williams say, "Okay, wheels touch down at 3:50 p.m. And I suddenly thought to myself, oh my God, 3:50 p.m. Eastern Time is 19:50 Greenwich Mean Time. The Pope landed at 19.5. Enough said. Moving on. The second item on our page tonight, othersideofmidnight.com, is a very intriguing article written by the journalist who used to work for the New York Times and had a column for many, many, many years in the Times on the op-ed page, Frank Rich. He has now written a really interesting piece for the New York Magazine, and it's called basically The Importance of Donald Trump. If you click on it, and I'm going to go and look at it myself as we speak, if you click on it, you will see that he has some very interesting words about Trump that I have not heard any other mainstream pundit actually voice up until now. And so let me read you from what he says. As the summer of Donald Trump comes to its end, and the prospect of a springtime for Trump no longer seems a gag, the quest to explain the billionaire's runaway clown car went into overdrive. How could a crass, bigoted bully with a narcissistic personality disorder and policy views bordering on gibberish defy political gravity, dominate the national stage, make monkeys out of pundits and pollsters, and pose an existential threat to one of America's two major parties? Of course, it was the news media's fault. The Washington Post charted the correlation between Trump's national polling numbers and his disproportionate press coverage, or maybe the public was to blame. Op-ed writers dusted off their sermons about American childish infatuation with celebrities and reality television, or perhaps Trump was one of the GOP's answers to the outsider Bernie Sanders, even though Sanders, unlike Trump, has a coherent ideology and has spent nearly a quarter of a century of his so-called outsider career in Congress. Still, others riffed through the historical precedents from third-party runs of cranky billionaire Ross Perot back to Huey Long and Father Charles Coughlin, the radio-savvy populist demagogues of the Great Depression. Or might Trump be the reincarnation of Joseph McCarthy, Hugh Chavez, or the avatar of white racist sentiment George Wallace? The historian Richard Hofstadter's Goldwater-era essay on the paranoid style in American politics was once again in vogue. In the midst of all the hand-wringing from conservatives and liberals alike, Politico convened a panel of historians to adjudicate. Two authoritative chroniclers of 20th-century American populism and race, Alan Brinkley of Columbia and David Blight of Yale, dismissed the parallels. Brinkley, the author of the definitive book on Long and Coughlin, Voices of Protest, said Trump was a first in American politics, a presidential candidate with no belief system other than the certainty that anything he says is right. Blight said Trump's real antecedents are in Mark Twain, in other words, fictional characters and funny ones. There is indeed a lighter way to look at Trump's rise and his impact on the country. Far from being an apocalyptic harbinger of the end times, it's possible that his buffoonery poses no lasting danger. Quite the contrary. his unexpected monopoly of center stage may well be the best thing to happen to our politics since the arrival of Barack Obama. So says Frank Rich. It's a long article. It's very nuanced. It's got lots of interesting stuff in it. But what I find intriguing is that Rich, as well as us and others, are looking at the Trump phenomenon from a very long distance through the other end of the telescope, and in fact are seeing the, you know, tremors in the force, the strange upset of the entire political process that this individual has created, and is actually looking forward and anticipating to very interesting things, as do we all. Okay, moving on. A third item on our list tonight is the Other Side of Midnight official YouTube channel. Yes, OtherSideOfMidnight.com has an official YouTube channel. And it's right there at the top of the page. If you click on that link, Other Side of Midnight YouTube, it takes you to our page. And, of course, on that page, we have one major item so far, the two-hour program we did a few days ago with Will Farrer, Andrew Curry, Keith Laney, and Bob Harrison, and myself, discussing the extraordinary, amazing imagery from Pluto and the asteroid Ceres, given us by the two NASA missions, the New Horizons mission and the NASA Dawn mission. And as we go through this discussion of what the imagery means, Will Farrer has done an incredible job. He's one of our new guys on the block, new imaging guy, who we're going to have actually back on to have a full show or a major part of a full show in the coming, you know, three weeks now. But what Will has done is he took all the imagery that we discussed that night during the live show, and he's very carefully arranged it, edited it so that it seamlessly flows, and as our conversation ebbs and flows, you can actually follow along on this YouTube video, Radio with Pictures, so that you get a feel for what the program is like. And obviously the reason that we're putting it up there is that a lot of you send me emails still saying, well, you're kind of on late at night and I really can't hang around, but oh yeah, there's that thing you're talking about, you know, Club 19.5. How do I join and, you know, get access to the archive? So if you watch this video, in fact, you will find out how do you join Club 19.5. Okay, I think that brings me to the end of most of the news items that I was going to cover. As I said, tonight is open lines again. We're opening hailing frequencies to everyone out there. So if you want to call, our numbers are 505-796-8802. That's 505-796-8802. Or our Skype name, as you should know by now, is Enterprise Mission. And that's gets directly to us. And don't all flood the lines at once, okay? Take your time. Let's see, while we're waiting for people to screw up the courage to actually call, what else should I talk about? Oh yeah, tonight, or actually this morning, is the beginning of the equinox. That's the position where the Earth, as it goes around the sun twice a year, is at a 90-degree angle to the other two points, the solstices, and so it's equal night. And let's see, we've got a caller calling in. Where are you calling from, and who are you?
Hey, Richard, it's Matt from Denver.
Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. Hey, hopefully there'll be some healing for Jimmy Carter. I know you're, I believe, still, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Every time we ping the force, you know, positive things happen. And one thing you have to understand about the way the torsion field works, it's not how intense the action is, it's the repetition. That's why in homeopathy you have to repeat the treatment again and again and again. So it's the repetition. Every time we mention Jimmy Carter, and every time we mention the idea that we're sending coherency, resonance, healing energy, whatever you want to call it, it entrains all those other people who are thinking similar thoughts, as Ms. Labrador said last night, and something may, in fact, happen. And I'm sure we will hear if something miraculous does happen. So, yes, we are continuing our experiment with trying to keep Jimmy around for as long as possible because he has more work to do.
Definitely. Hey, do you want to go ahead and talk about this since it is really, actually, really current news and it's all over social media? I think it'd be perfect for you. That Martin Shkreli, that guy who bought the patent for...
Oh, my God. I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, this is a quintessential example. I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to mention this. A quintessential example of the good are getting better and the bad are getting worse.
The good's going to prevail on this one.
Well, hang on. For those who aren't following the story, this is a young 32-year-old hedge fund guy who bought this obscure little company that makes a drug for about 12,000 people on the planet. There are 7 billion people on Earth, and this is a drug that affects basically about 12,000 people who either have AIDS or have, you know, contracted trichinosis or, you know, some other very related disease. And it costs about $1 a pill to make the medication. When this individual bought the company, the pills were selling for $13.50 per pill, which is, you know, not trivial, but it's certainly not exorbitant compared to a range of other medications. In one day, he raised the price from $13.50 per pill to $750 per pill. That's right, from $13.50 to $750, a price rise of 5,000%. And then he looks into the camera during these various interviews and says, well, I'm just charging what the market will bear, and it's the low end of, you know, valuable drugs and all this. And, of course, it's created this huge firestorm on social media all over the world. And today he has come out and said, well, we're going to reduce the price. Now, I would like him to put the price back down to $13.50. Look, if he needs to actually keep the company functioning, which is critical because otherwise you can't make a drug, you know, $14, $15, something like that. But what he was trying to do was so aberrant. It was so disgusting.
Yeah.
And his position, his arrogance, his ability to look into the camera and say, I don't give a flying, you know what?
Oh, yeah.
Obviously.
Did you know, Richard, this isn't the first time he's done this.
No, I did.
He actually bought the patent of a kidney for kids with renal failure, a kidney medication, and he hiked that one up. That was $1 per pill for the cost, mm-hmm, to $30 per pill. So this isn't new. He's just not going after, like, people will say, oh, well, you know, that's just people that, you know, have that problem. That's really their thing. He has no problem doing it to children as well.
Apparently.
And that's what's really getting to me. If you want to go ahead and see what's going to happen, take a look at the guys that were behind the salmonella outbreak for the Peter Pan peanut butter.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the guy behind the peanut farm there and the person who's doing quality control, are going to get 29 years in prison.
Hmm.
So let's just hope.
Well,
these people will get reined in.
All right. Now, what is this guy's name again? I know the company is
this
Turing.
This is Martin Shkreli.
Martin Shkreli. That's the young CEO. He's about 32, 33, something like that.
Yeah.
The company is called Turing, which is ironic because we were discussing a Turing test last night. No relation, I'm sure. Let's watch and see how much he rolls back this extraordinary, disgusting price hike.
Yes. And he's also under investigation right now, too.
As he should be.
Not for that. He's under investigation for manipulating the FDA into going ahead. He was short-selling certain stocks. That's what alleged he was. Short-selling certain stocks.
I'm glad you added that. Yes. Alleged.
Petitioning the FDA to go ahead and push out his competition.
Hmm.
So that's a little insider trading and other things he could be found guilty of later. So it'll be interesting. I hope that, you know, justice will get reined in on people like this.
You know, what's so interesting is here's an example of arrogance that knows no bounds and is frankly kind of dumb. Because if he hadn't done this, if he'd raised the price maybe even to 20, 25, nobody would have called any attention to it, right?
Oh, yeah.
And all these other potential transgressions would not have come under public scrutiny, and there wouldn't have been an added pressure to look into everything else he's done, because obviously now he's not exactly the favorite of the social set, I would presume.
Yeah, he drew too much attention to himself.
Which, again, is arrogance oversteps.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of like the folks behind Iron Mountain.
Yeah, that's a good point, Richard. Well, I'm going to let somebody else get in on here, but I figured I would
I'm so glad you brought that up because, well, it was time. Okay, let's move on here. Let's see who else we have. Scott, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Richard. Let me turn down my device.
Oh, yes, yes.
Let me turn off the fan. It's nice and quiet here.
It used to be a phone. Now it's a device. Okay.
Indulge me. You probably didn't hear Art's show preceding yours.
No, I was actually prepping, and we had some website problems, so I was busy up till airtime.
Okay, well, the topic was climate change, which always brings the crazies out from under rocks and stuff. And I tried like hell to get in on Art's program, but just wasn't able to. So hopefully some of his listeners are sticking around for your program, and I can make these two quick points.
Actually, we have data. They do. So go ahead.
Okay. Well, first of all, it's pretty telling that one of the, if not the largest, public relations firm in the known universe, and I won't mention the name of it unless you say it's okay.
Oh, sure, mention it.
Okay, Hill & Knowlton.
Okay.
They've been around for, I think, since the 20s. And they, for many, many decades, were the chief cheerleader for the tobacco industry, doing all that they could to get the story out that tobacco smoking causes no ill effects whatsoever.
Were they behind the campaigns for the Marlboro Man?
No, that was the guy up in Chicago. Leo Burnett was the ad agency that created that campaign. And that reminds me, I'll send you an interesting video about that entire history.
Hmm.
But Hill & Knowlton basically is a public relations firm that works on behalf of clients all over the world.
So they're not an ad agency, they're a PR firm.
No, they're PR, and basically they do what they can to make their clients look good in the public eye.
Public image operations.
Yeah. So for decades, many decades, they just insisted that cigarette smoking was totally non-injurious to your health.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that field of endeavor kind of went into the crapper in the late 90s, so they had to find something new to do. And one of the new things they found to do was to become global climate change deniers.
Are they hired by the Koch brothers?
Oh, they're hired by other people who insists that climate change is not real, and if it is real, human beings have nothing to do with it. So I don't know if they're tied to the Koch brothers, but they are definitely mouthpieces for the climate change denial industry.
Okay, so this is building toward a climax of a story?
Well, that leads me to my second point, and that is the thing that I suggest sort of kiddingly to climate change deniers to do is a little experiment. Step one is to seal up all of the windows and doors in your home or apartment. Step two is to create a campfire in the middle of your living room. Step three is to set it on fire. Step four is to let it really get going. And step five is to hit a stopwatch and jot down exactly how many seconds it takes for you to come to the realization that human behavior does affect an environment. Now, a guy in the Art Bell Fans Under the Cover of Night Facebook chat room insisted that I was an idiot,
mm-hmm.
insisted that I was, made the claim that I had invited him to burn himself up. That's not at all the point of the exercise. The point of the exercise was to point out that as silly as that suggestion was, there is some truth to it. And here comes the question. How do people, reasonable, intelligent people, deny that for well over a century, the pumping of untold billions of tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere has absolutely no bearing on the climate of the planet that the atmosphere surrounds? So if you could talk about that and give me a scientific response for people that's better than my indoor campfire idea, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. Well, let me take it under advisement. You know, I've been watching this debate, this really emotional hot under the collar debate from even before Art was mentioning climate change back in the 90s. He would bring it up, and there'd be this vitriolic reaction. And I was kind of curious. I wonder why people are so emotionally invested on either side of the issue. It seems to be something you should be able to, again, scientifically assess, make reasonable judgment, and then decide that if, you know, mass social behavior, cultural behavior, civilization's behavior is doing something that's ultimately going to wind up, you know, raising the temperature of the planet to where we can no longer live on the planet, obviously you need to do something different. So I've actually looked into where the denial is coming from, and I think a lot of it has to do with fundamental religious values. The idea that the earth was given to us to be stewards, and we can do with it whatever we will under the framework of stewardship, whereas stewardship actually means you take care of something. And
yeah.
I think a lot of this has to do with people's ignorance of the concept of stewardship, or the idea that you basically don't know anything about the subject yourself, so you have to trust other people. And the other people they're trusting are also people that don't know any science, so it kind of snowballs, and you have this mass political effect where the blind are leading the blind, and there is a kind of a predisposition to think that, oh my God, the earth is so incredibly huge, and God wouldn't have done anything that would allow us to, you know, muck it up in any way. So obviously people who say that we're affecting it are basically attacking God's work.
Yeah, it's a trick of the devil.
Yeah.
And here's the deal, though. You're on the right track, because the religious folks who believe that sort of theology are what they call dominionists. That is to say, God gave human beings dominion over the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't mean that God told them to go trash it, which is what they apparently think, you know, is the exercise. But the thing is, it's just astounding that otherwise intelligent people buy into this. And, you know, to take it a step further with the religious folk, they think that ultimately Jesus is coming back to make everything okay, and what does it matter anyway?
Do you remember James Watts, who was, I think, President Reagan's Secretary of the Interior?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He was on an airplane heading from D.C. to Yellowstone or, you know, one of the major national parks to do something. And he had some press on board, and they were obviously asking questions. And they asked him the question about, you know, stewardship and taking care, you know, being a true conservative, conserving resources, conserving the environment, conserving the future for our kids and our grandkids and our great-grandkids. And James Watt, officially appointed Secretary of the Interior, looked at the press, looked at the reporters, and he says, well, I don't have to worry about that because God is coming back. Jesus is coming back, and all will be taken care of.
Yeah, yeah. It makes you just kind of shake your head and hope that the end comes quickly. You know. So
okay,
anyway,
we have them.
I figured I'd toss that in because there are two I thought valid points that should be, you know, part of the conversation.
And I think you're right, and I appreciate the input.
Okay, man. Take care.
You too. Bye. Okay, we've got Benjamin on the line. Where are you calling from? Please turn down your device. I hear noises in the background like you're on a road trip on a dark, you know, midnight highway somewhere.
Sorry about that. The last caller really got me riled up, but because I'm like, you know what? I can look out. I can go outside. I can look in the sky, and there's plenty of day, especially here in Southern California, where you could clearly see what looks like somebody's tire treads all in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And just a few days ago, we actually got a normal storm, and I Anyways, I just made note of the fact that there was an incredible, well, probably a mostly natural storm, but there was an incredible difference in the appearance of the clouds. They were white. They were puffy. They were low.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have that high cloud deck that you usually see, or cloud ceiling that you see when there's obvious weather manipulation going on. But how do you make the distinction?
Hang on. Why don't you hang it there? Because we've got a break at the bottom of the hour here. We'll come back to you. We'll pick up the conversation right there. Tonight I'm going to play some bumpers from our friend Amanda Best. This is one of her favorites, Something Between You and Me. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we'll be right back.
Or if you're dreaming about me.
She actually wrote the song. She's not singing it. She's singing the duet in the background.
Look just like you. She's smiling at me. Grab my phone to call you, tell you how much I want you, but you don't want nothing with me. You don't want to love me, but I'm on to you, baby. When you look at me, a wave of passion crashes, my heart beats faster. There's no denying, there's something between you and me.
And good morning once again. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and you are on the other side of midnight, and we're talking with Ben about global warming. Ben? Oh.
Yes, I was, you know, there's a really good web channel called The HARP Report, and I really recommend anyone who wants to get caught up on weather manipulation, how it works, how to make observations, things you could do to prove it to yourself. There's a wealth of resource on that particular YouTube channel.
Now, when you say HARP, you don't mean angels. You mean HAARP, High Altitude Auroral Activation Research Project, right?
Yeah, yes, yes. I forget the guy's name. I think it's Mike, but just check out that web channel. And there's another thing too. How can I put this? There's two things I want to say.
just keep it clean. It's a family show.
It's a little bit of your information combined with some of the information from Marshall Masters, I believe, and the whole Planet X stuff. And it, to me, the best smoking gun proof he's got of his take on things is the Tegucigalpa volcanic feed, in which you could see clearly these planets.
Wait. Planet X is a hoax. Planet X does not exist. Do you know how I know?
How?
If Planet X was either a planet or even a small star, like a red dwarf, as it approached the solar system, the gravitational effects would change the periods of the planetary orbits, their years, such that we would see discrepancies in all the amateur astronomy programs for millions of amateur astronomers all over the world. They'd be setting their coordinates in their telescopes looking for Saturn or looking for Venus or whatever, and it wouldn't be in the field of view. So there'd be a huge groundswell propagated, obviously, by the Internet of a lot of very angry astronomers saying, where the heck is the stuff that it's supposed to be where this program says it is, and it's not there? And nothing like that's happening. So you cannot have a Planet X or a rogue star or whatever body is out there that someone is claiming, Nibiru, whatever, approaching us without having effects. And the effects aren't there, therefore something cannot be approaching.
Well, wouldn't some of the effects possibly be like changing weather patterns?
No. Because unless you have an object you can establish its reality, you can't have effects from that object. You know,
okay,
very
so
simple logic. The reason we're getting wild and weird changing weather, in addition to man-made activities, dumping, you know, CO2 in the atmosphere and all that, is the change in the modulation of the torsion field because of the motions of the planets around the sun, its normal modulation. But when you add the peak of that cycle to the peak of the primitive human technology cycle burning fossil fuels, that's where you get the planet into trouble. So one or the other has to give. In other words, if we could find an alternative to fossil fuels tomorrow and implement that on a planet-wide basis, that would solve the man-made part of the equation, but it wouldn't solve the natural physics part. That's an additional piece of science we need to get a handle on and get it, you know, kind of quickly.
Okay, I just have one more point to make on that, and then I'll bounce over to one quick little point. Then what are we looking at when we see this Tiriapa volcanic feat, and what is that? I mean, I've heard Marshall Masters really break down the whole sun dog
and
reflections.
First of all, Marshall Masters is not one of my favorite people. I must tell you right up front. Okay, so data coming from Marshall Masters, I am very suspicious of.
Okay.
Remember, there are all kinds of people out there with agendas.
I believe you.
Religious agendas, economic agendas, political agendas. You must track back to original sources. So when you see YouTube videos or whatever showing whatever in the sky, for God's sake, go outside, take a telescope, and look yourself. You can do that. That's the one part of this whole thing that's so democratizable, because they, whoever they are, can't hide the sky.
Well, you know,
but you can't depend on the internet to see it. You got to go and look yourself.
Yeah, that's part of the issue, because it seems like there's an answer for every objection raised. So I'm just throwing it out there just to see if I could get, you know, if there's some other source that sort of substantively, thoroughly sort of rebuts, you know, whatever argument he might be putting forth. I'm totally open-minded.
The simple rebuttal is get an 8-inch telescope, learn astronomy, point it at where these objects are supposed to be, and use your good old Mark I eyeball to test the idea.
Okay. My other point is, well, just how well carbon dioxide hold heat, say, compared to water vapor, and how much, you know, what kind of fluctuation in temperature what we feel? I mean, we feel huge swings in temperature just on how much water vapor there is in the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. So but in general, look, weather is what happens day to day. Climate's what happens century to century. So everybody's making up, I mean, even Trump's got this, you know, backwards. We don't care about weather. Weather is not a trend curve. Weather occurs because of an accumulation of factors that are local. Things happen, and then the energy dissipates. What we're looking at are long-term trends. And if you look at the observatory in Hawaii, I forget which one, that monitors the CO2 index, there has been a monotonic increase year after year after year for decade after decade after decade.
And monotonic?
Meaning that it's almost like a straight line. All right, it's like a straight line. It's not a curve. It's basically a slope line going up and up and up and up. And the more CO2 we put in the atmosphere, you know, you can do experiments in high school physics lab where you can measure the absorption of heat, the retention of heat, the so-called greenhouse effect. That cannot not be having an effect. So then you ask the question, what are the effects it's having? And what we see is an increasingly bewilderingly unusual occurrence of local weather. For instance, here in the American Southwest, in the land of enchantment, we have been having 85 to 90 degree days up until just a couple of days ago. And we're at the equinox. We're almost into winter. In fact, in another, you know, few months, it will be winter. But of course, things get much colder quicker than the winter solstice. So it's the like fact that weather patterns are being disturbed worldwide should be an indication to intelligent, thinking people that something is changing the global dynamics of weather patterns. And that, of course, is the long-term forcing function of heat being trapped more and more and more, plus more energy being dumped into the system, as I said, because the background physics is also changing.
I agree with you. I guess it goes back to what you said earlier about testing things yourself. I mean, the guy on that HARP report basically was advocating the same thing, you know, because people are so skeptical about him. He's basically advocating the same thing. Go out there and, you know, start taking measurements. And, you know, that's a possible means of distinguishing what's weather control and what's natural.
I agree. Okay.
All right. That's it for now.
All right. We'll talk soon.
Okay. Good night.
Good night. Okay. And please turn down your device. Please turn down your radio. Down. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Yeah. Hi. This is Tom. I'm calling from Washington State.
Hi, Tom.
Good evening. I really still hear you.
I still can hear your phone or whatever.
Okay, let me get it. Okay.
Kill it. Take a baseball bat. Bash it down.
Okay, it's down.
Excellent. Okay. What would you like to talk about?
I would like to talk about precession.
Oh, precession.
Do you know? Yes, precession. Mm-hmm. Can you say what is the theory, current theory, do black holes exhibit precession?
Well, current theory is that in order to have a celestial body precess, meaning it kind of wobbles like a top, you know, if you take a top, put it on a tabletop, and you spin it up, and as it's spinning down because of friction with the contact with the table or the floor, it will lean over,
yes,
and it'll begin to wobble around, and then it'll kind of fall over. That's the analogy. That's the metaphor for celestial precession of actual spinning, rotating planetary or stellar type objects. In the standard model, to get precession, you need either changing currents inside the body that's rotating, so you change where the mass is relative to the axis, or you need two bodies orbiting around each other, influencing each other and causing each other to precess. So I am not aware off the top of my head of any black hole observations of precession of black holes. I'm trying to think how they would make the observations, because you really can only see the so-called accretion disk in a black hole observation. And that accretion disk, even if the black hole inside was precessing, that would not necessarily be transmitted to the accretion disk except over a long, you know, amount of time. So I'm not quite sure where we're going with this, because I think the observation itself would be very difficult with current state-of-the-art technology to actually make.
All right. The follow-up question to that is, we don't know what that theory is, would the gravity well follow precession? Or would it be pointed off in some other direction? 19.5.
Again, off the top of my head, I don't know, but I will tell you one interesting thing. Before Bruce De Palma, you know, died, he and I actually made a proposal to the Lewis Research Center, since renamed the Glenn Research Center, which is one of NASA's centers in Cleveland. They have what they call a zero-gravity drop tower at NASA Glenn, which is, I think it's a 50, 60, maybe 100-foot deep hole in the ground with a tower above it, and you have a test article that you take to the top of the tower. You put instruments in it, you put experiments, whatever. You let it go, and it takes, I think, about 5 seconds to fall down from the tower into the hole in the ground. It's got a cushioned landing system, so you can reuse the container, but you've got 5 seconds of zero gravity to play with. So one of the things that De Palma and I were proposing to NASA Lewis at that time, that was the name, was that we basically take a sphere, like a red ball or a blue ball or something, and we paint lines on it, and we spin it up in some kind of a containment mechanism so it's spinning very fast, and then we drop it down the zero-gravity tower. So in the 5 seconds or so while it's falling and it's in real zero G, we would see if the spinning ball or the spinning sphere actually also precessed, because his experimental data And our hyperdimensional torsion field model said that in some circumstances, precession can actually originate from within a spinning object connected to the torsion field, having nothing to do with the rearrangement of mass inside or the presence of another nearby object which is gravitationally tugging on the other spinning object and causing it to precess, which, of course, is the explanation for how the moon is supposed to be tugging gravitationally on the Earth and causing the Earth's precession every 25, 26,000 years. Unfortunately, Bruce died before we could actually get permission to do the experiment, so that still is an experiment I would like to do. You can do it in either their zero-gravity drop tower, which was the cheapest way. You could also do it in what's called the Vomit Comet, which is this aircraft, this four-engine jet aircraft they use to simulate zero-gravity for the astronauts in 30- or 35-second parabolas. So you could actually spin up a sphere and then wait till the plane went into the zero-g parabola, let it go, photograph the hell out of it with video and all that, and see if it precessed on its own as opposed to needing an external gravitational tug to begin a precession. That experiment should be done. As far as I know, it has not been done, but it would produce radically different results because then it would tell us that precession, in some cases, is a higher dimensional example, proof of the extension of higher dimensions into our dimension and the connection between dimensions causing forces in our 3D reality which are unmodeled by current physical equations.
The body you spin up, that would that be solid like a bowling ball, or would that have a core of a different material?
You could make a whole range of them. So you could test layering, you could test condensation, you could test masses that were uniform, that were uniform density. You could test, glass spheres that had, like, let's say, a shell of water with a hollow center. You could test all different models to see how precession, basically anchored in the torsion field, differed from precession caused by gravitational body interactions. It's an experiment someone should do. The ideal place to do it is the space station. Or, if Elon Musk gets cheaper access into space, we might be able to convince him to conduct an experiment like that.
Yeah, that would be a great idea. Okay, can I have one more?
One more. There's a lot of people stacked up, but one more.
Yes, two bodies spinning around each other, as you described earlier. Do they precess?
They should, according to standard theory. And we do see examples in close binary stars. We see examples in, we see the Earth-Moon example. But again, that's not a crystal clear example because there are other possibilities. And that's why it'd be nice to separate the internal hyperdimensional reasons for precession from the external 3D Newtonian gravitational reasons for precession, which is where mainstream theory is now.
You're the best, Richard. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And let's go to Kalashar. Kalashar, what an interesting name. Where are you calling from?
Hi, Richard. It's Johnny from Philly.
Johnny from Philly. I like Kalashar better. Come on.
Actually came from
Harry's. And I place. Love your picture. God, the sun shining through the flag and that forward scattering producing that cross. Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, pretty cool stuff.
Okay, so what's your question?
It's actually kind of a comment. It has to do with, remember you had Tim Wallace Murphy on the other night? I'm sort of a scholar in that area. I'm not so much in his area, but in the Trevor Ravenscroft area. And he brought up the fact that he wrote a book with Trevor Ravenscroft.
Mm-hmm.
It was called The Mark of the Beast, where Ravenscroft had written prior to that when they were called Spear of Destiny and the Cup of Destiny.
Mm-hmm.
And in Ravenscroft's description, he mentions a guy named Walter Johann Stein, who wrote Ninth Century in the Holy Grail. And Stein was Ravenscroft's mentor. And he was a Grail initiate. And he describes two schools of Christianity that existed in the 9th century. One is what we have today, which is the outer school. And one is the Grail tradition, which is sort of the inner school. And what Tim does is he sort of suggests that they're mutually exclusive. And I don't believe that they are. I believe that they coexist for a reason.
Now, when you say he insists they're exclusive, did he do that on the show, or does he do that in his own writings?
He was sort of doing it on the show, basically saying that, you know, that the outer teaching today is really all false, and there's an inner teaching that the real purpose of spirituality is something different. And it's not so much the real purpose; it's just there's a deeper purpose. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of Christians are not going to like what I'm saying, and I see myself as a Christian because I believe in the outer as well. But if you really look at like what Stein taught is that quest for the Grail, he claims to have achieved it, and on achieving the Grail, all of his past lives were revealed to him. One of which was he was Joseph of Arimathea. He claims to have been. I mean, I can't know for sure.
Sure,
it's really what you trust, and I trust Stein. I trust Ravenscroft. I have a difficult time with the guys like Pike and the Freemasonic side that talks about a bloodline. What Stein talked about was pure blood, which means purifying your own blood through basically right living. That's the easiest way to do it. There's more to it than that. But he claims to have been Joseph of Arimathea at the crucifixion, catching the blood of Jesus in the Holy Grail, which was the cup of redemption from the Passover ceremony. And I just think that I wanted to point out that Wallace Murphy seemed to be misrepresenting Ravenscroft. I can't say who's right or wrong. I just wanted to clarify that there's more to it than what he was representing. He's more the Freemasonic side of things.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk a lot about the bloodline of Jesus, where the Grail Christianity, which is what Ravenscroft, Stein, and a guy named Rudolf Steiner talk about. Everyone has access to these super sensory abilities, and they can be opened up. Like I said, a lot of the fundamentalist Christians are going to freak. Let me say that.
I'll tell you what, when we have Tim back, obviously you're going to call in, you're going to put this to him, and we'll all find out what he says.
Well, I would love to talk to him. I really would. And I feel bad because he can't answer me, but I think
But we are going to have him back on the show, so you'll make sure you note that, and you'll come on, and you'll ask him the question.
I will. And I'm just so you know, I totally agree with you on Sitchin, by the way. Sitchin and the whole Planet X thing. I'm a linguist. I was a linguist in the United States Air Force. And when I read Sitchin, I sat down, and I'm open to this stuff. I'm interested in it. And when I read his what he did with language, he basically says if one word sounds like another word, they must be related. And he does this over and over and over again, just non sequitur after non sequitur. And it's basically, even if he's right about the Anunnaki and all that, his math all the way through, his reasoning, is totally wrong. And guys like Marshall Masters, there's one guy that's in that school. His name is John Moore, who I really like. John is a really good man.
John who?
John Moore. He's
John Moore, okay.
Yeah, former military, former police detective, very bright guy, and he's totally sold. It just seems to me like he was totally sold on Planet X. And he tends to trust sources that I wouldn't trust if I were him.
See, I don't like trusting sources. I like trusting data. Now, if sources tell me something in confidence, and we have a lot of people that do that, what I do is then I turn to my objective data sources and I try to cross-correlate to see if there's information that will support what a source is telling me. But too many people in the age of the internet rely on too many other people, faceless strangers, as we were talking last night, Georgia and I. You know, just because something's channeled doesn't make it true. And just
Amen
because someone's on the internet and claims to have found, you know, the Holy Grail doesn't mean they have.
And that's true.
One needs to test. You know, it's the old trust but verify.
And I don't claim to have achieved that. I understand. I think I have a good understanding of the path, but let's just say that I'm not disciplined enough yet to be there.
Well, it's all a work in progress. I mean, none of us are perfect. The thing is, do you try? Too many people I know just accept what an expert, in quotes, tells them, and they don't do any digging themselves. I mean, with the sky, if something's summing in the sky and someone is telling you there's something astonishing in the sky, wouldn't your inclination be to go outside and take a look for yourself?
I check everything. Some things are harder to check than others, though, you know?
But if it's visible with a telescope and is being put on the web, then obviously it's visible with a telescope and you can look at it with your eyes or look at it with a camera or something for yourself.
absolutely. As far as Planet X goes, yeah. And I just, all I see is pictures of the sun close to the horizon showing.
Mm-hmm. With lots of internal lens scattering.
Yeah. It's not, I would definitely be on the skeptic side of that argument.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call. We'll talk soon.
Okay, Richard, thanks a lot.
Okay. You are on the air. Give us your name, where you're calling from, and please turn down the background noises. It's kind of disturbing. Hello?
Yes, Richard. Hey, I wanted to find out, you know, I want to ask you a question about the lunar landing about the moon. You know, I was watching this video on YouTube about the heat on the moon, the actual heat index on the moon itself.
Mm-hmm.
And they were describing, saying that how can you be on the moon and being able to, like, they showed a picture, somebody actually cooked a picture in an oven and said that the heat on the moon is actually, what is the Fahrenheit, what is the actual, the heat index on the moon?
The range of temperatures on the moon, and we're going to come up to a break here, so I'm going to hold you over so we can have a more thorough discussion after the break.
Oh, okay.
But the temperature of the moon during daytime is about 250 degrees above zero Fahrenheit.
Okay.
After sunset, when the sun is no longer in the sky, because the moon rotates very slowly,
I understand that. It's colder.
The temperature falls to about 250 below Fahrenheit.
I understand that.
Okay, so there's a range of about 500 degrees. Now, anything you put in exposed under that environment would be subjected to those temperatures, but nothing we've taken to the moon or nothing that we have done in terms of man-made probes or even the Apollo missions have expose themselves nakedly to those temperatures. So hold the thought there. We'll come back after the break, and we will pick this up right there. Again, we're doing tonight some interesting vocals by Amanda Best. This one's called I Found You, which is a metaphor for me and this show and all of you guys out there on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
I searched every new face to find my prince, wondering when he'd come to me. The heartbreaks and detours broke me down. I'd almost given up. Then I found you. Seem to fade next to your shine. A dream only my heart knew. I found you.
And we are back. Sorry about that. Excuse me.
Oh, okay.
Little computer hiccup. You were saying?
Yes, Richard. I wanted to know about the temperatures on the moon.
Okay.
Actually, so you're saying the temperatures on the moon are 250 degrees Fahrenheit?
If you're in the sun on the day side of the moon, where is that noise coming from in the background?
Oh, okay.
There's all kinds of weird, like you're traveling at warp 9 or something.
It's done. It's finished.
Okay. All right, so you're on the moon. You're standing there naked. You don't have a spacesuit. You don't have any clothes on. It's 250 degrees in the sunlight, and you die because not of the heat, but because you asphyxiate very quickly and your body explodes, et cetera, because it's a vacuum. Every object we have sent to the moon, and that noise is really driving me nuts. I'll tell you what, let's pick this up. You have some noise in your system that's not, I don't think we can continue. We can't broadcast with this.
Why?
So call me back. Call me back when you get rid of the noise. Thank you. Okay, let's go to this individual. Good morning. Who are you? And where are you calling from?
I'm Jay from Kansas City.
Hi, Jay. Go for it. Tell us, what is it you want to know? Who do you want to talk about?
I'd like to talk about the huge three cigar cylinders on Pluto.
Okay.
Have you seen that, Mr. Hoagland?
Well, I've looked at a lot of new imagery. By the way, there's some new Pluto imagery coming up this Thursday, day after, well, actually tomorrow now. And Stern, Alan Stern, hang on. Alan Stern says he's going to blow our minds with amazing imagery. I have not seen any massive cylinders on the Pluto imagery. I've seen an awful lot of habitats, a tremendous amount of geometry, a lot of smash geometry, a lot of ice, a lot of what looks like sloshing and freezing and exotic, extraordinarily exotic conditions of, you know, liquid nitrogen temperatures 300 below zero and strange atmospheric fogs and layerings and all that. But I have not seen cylinders yet. Where are they?
Have you seen any UFO activity?
No.
On Pluto?
No.
About Pluto?
How would we see UFO activity? The imagery we're getting are stills, you know, snapshots recorded on the computer memory in the spacecraft, then sent down the data link at 2,000 bits per second. Takes about 42 minutes to send down one high-resolution image. Yeah. They're stored on the ground, and computers are given to us, but they're given to us as a series of stills. And those streaks you see above the horizon on the latest crescent image, the really stunning crescent Pluto image taken looking back, those streaks...
That's a cigar-shaped UFO.
No.
Like?
Those are stars. The exposure was a time exposure. It was a scan. The time it took to take the image, the stars moved relative to the planet, and the spacecraft was told, keep the planet still, so something had to give, and the stars are moving, but the planet is sharp.
How fast is that going, do you know?
Well, as the spacecraft went past Pluto, it was moving at over 32,000 miles per hour.
Jeepers.
And the planet is only 1,500 miles in diameter, and they whip by at 7,000 plus miles. So you can imagine that at those velocities, with such a small relative object, the rates and the relative motion would show things smearing and streaking very quickly unless you compensate for all the motions. And the one thing they decided to sacrifice were the stars, because we want to look at the planet, not the stars. So that's why you have these weird little streaks in the sky on the crescent image. Those are stars. Those are not UFOs. They're IFOs. We've identified what they are. They're identified stellar object, ISOs.
Thank you, Mr. Holden.
Okay.
Clearing that up. Thank
All
you very
right.
much.
Well, thanks for calling.
Yep.
And we'll go to our next call. Your name and where are you calling from? And please turn down your device. Please turn down your phone.
Yes. My name's Claudia, and I have a lot of questions for you, Richard.
Well, let's not hog all the airtime. Ask me one or two.
Sure. You used to be on Art Bell when William Thomas... Do you remember who William Thomas was?
Yeah, big chemtrail guy.
And he did... collect all the evidence. He does have, and he took them all to the labs. It was proven. If you remember when William Thomas
was on. Are we arguing about the same thing, or are we even arguing? Because William Thomas was doing good science, and he was talking about chemtrails, not global warming.
Yes, but the chemtrails are causing the haze that goes across the sky every day. We don't have the blue skies anymore. We don't have normal clouds. And, like, even myself, like you say, take the evidence. I have thousands of pictures of these skies that are just off the chart.
We're not arguing. I agree there is, you know, chemtrails being spread in the stratosphere, varying from location to location. Some days here in New Mexico we have incredible crystal clear blue skies, and other days it's very hazy. And you can actually see the haze spreading from the chemtrails as something up there, some jet, is spewing out something. So that is not in argument. That's not in contention. What is in contention is the background climate warming of the planet is a due to man-made effects, and that's where all the political argument is coming from.
Well, the geoengineering is part of all these programs.
Exactly, like because it's the antithesis to the global warming. What the global warming folks don't seem, or the deniers don't seem to know, is there's an actual program, and one of our colleagues found the papers from, I believe it was NASA Lewis, which actually showed a recommended program of massive aerosol distribution by aircraft dumping stuff out of airplanes to spread a haze layer over the Earth to reflect more sunlight back into space, thus lowering the temperature and counteracting global warming. The problem is, if you do enough of that, you wind up with all kinds of other collateral problems that you don't want, like toxic metals.
A lot of aluminum.
Yeah, of course.
Aluminum on, yeah. And now, starting to damage.
Well, but see, there's another interesting angle on this. Since people have actually measured the chemical composition now of some of these chemtrails, and William Thomas was one of those people, we know that there is aluminum and barium and other, you know, light metals in this mix. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Someone asked me many, many years ago, is it possible that the spreading of this aluminum aerosol is not to ameliorate the effects of global warming at all, but basically to create a field, a screen, where the torsion field does not interact with human beings on the Earth, because as we know, aluminum is a shield against torsion waves, against torsion radiation. So if you were actually trying to make the planet dumber, you might do that, so you would screen the interactions between consciousness on Earth and the background field. And so that wild, bizarre idea, actually, when you kind of think about it, may not be so bizarre and wild after all. But, of course, in order to measure this at a quantitative level, we'd have to take the experiments into a lab, and we'd have to, you know, basically do a range of experiments that, as far as I'm aware, no one has done.
Yes, but the aluminum, you know, if it's in high quantity, which it is when it's collected and been turned in and proven, aluminum causes memory loss. You know, it's like what causes Alzheimer's.
Well, that's what I was just talking about.
From the aluminum that's
What I was just talking about is that aluminum, we know, screens torsion. If consciousness, if self-awareness, if our identities are based on our connection of our physical bodies here with the ether, with the torsion field, and there's something preventing that connection, then yes, you'd have the effects of Alzheimer's in people who were basically cut off from their source. Again, these are scenarios, these are models. I'm not married to this. I'm just putting it out there as possibilities.
Right. Now, on the HARP, have you done any reading on the HARP?
Oh, of course.
To make any kind of decisions?
Well, I know Nick Begich quite well, and he and I had extensive discussions going back years, decades, on HARP.
Now, doesn't it make holes in the ionosphere?
It doesn't make holes. What it does is the HARP is basically a series of antennas located in Alaska, north of Fairbanks. But it's like when we say Kleenex, we're really talking about, you know, tissues. So HARP is a general application of a name to a technology of which there are many now stations scattered around the world. It's not just no longer in Alaska. The idea in the mainstream literature on HARP is that you beam high-powered microwaves into the ionosphere. You heat the ionosphere, and then the heating causes a plasma to form, electrons and parent nuclei swimming around together, electrically neutral together, but separated as positive and negative charges. And that plasma will act as a reflector for microwaves, as a you can use it to change the flow and the pattern of jet streams. You can modify the way the sun interacts with the upper atmosphere. You can do a whole bunch of things by simply heating a portion of the ionosphere. Now, what is not talked about in these mainstream papers is that it's also an incredible way to produce torsion field radiation, because plasmas, if you resonate them, if you cause them to ring or to spin in certain ways, as you pump in the electromagnetic radiation, what comes out is invisible to radio detectors, to radio receivers, but it's a very powerful source of invisible torsion field modulated radiation. And we have been able...
Isn't it also affecting the electromagnetic field?
Yeah, but that's secondary. See, the real action is not in the electromagnetic field. This is where everybody kind of, I think, gets off the beam because they're looking at what they call EM weapons as dangerous. It's not the electromagnetics that's dangerous. It's the torsion field that the electromagnetics create in plasmas. And we have been able to actually measure with our torsion field detector, the good old little Accutron, changes in the frequency of the Accutron during times when HARP is being activated, and you can see the spiky frequency changes in a very short period of time, ramping way up and down in frequency, thousands of times.
When they shoot it, and then it goes to another area, does it change a jet stream when it does that?
That's one of the models that they can change jet stream movements.
Yes, and they're doing that with HARP.
Yeah, because it's used as a heater. But I'm talking about the invisible effects of HARP, the torsion effects of HARP, which nobody is talking about because they don't know that they exist. No one has read the literature that torsion fields are created by excited plasmas. So to me, the real reason that HARP is potentially dangerous has nothing to do with the electromagnetic effects. It has to do with the creation of the invisible torsion field effects, which have all kinds of direct interaction with human consciousness per our measurements at the pyramids. And so that's really what I should be looking at and you should be looking at, and no one is talking about.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, thanks. But, it did worry me about changing the jet stream, though, because sometimes I just feel like that, you would know, you're the scientist. But when the jet stream changes like that, it could be perfectly calm in one area, and when they shoot the HARP, all of a sudden there's a big storm because it goes in an arc.
Well, no, I'm not saying that's not an operation. I'm not saying it's something we shouldn't worry about, but it's one of the known effects of HARP. When the Air Force proposed to Congress to create this technology to do this experimentation, one of the things they talked about is changing weather by manipulating the lower atmosphere through connections to the upper atmosphere where they're going to dump the energy in terms of these spot beams. So, yeah, that's something to be concerned about, but I'm much more intrigued with the unseen, hidden effects of the creation of the torsion radiation, which can have direct influence on human consciousness, as we have measured, and we have no idea what modulation of those torsion waves could do in terms of getting people to do all kinds of things they wouldn't normally do. In other words, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Sorry. Maybe that's where the expression zombies is coming from.
Maybe. Well, to me,
it is affecting the consciousness. There's no doubt. You could see it when you're on the streets. It's like people are lost. It's not. You could see it.
Well, if you talk to Robin, she'll say it's because we're a drugged up society and we take a pill for everything.
Oh.
Okay.
Well, that's really interesting about that torsion. So what do you think it would actually do besides just consciousness? Anything else? Unbelievable.
Well, you can do all kinds of things if you can manipulate the torsion field. You can create anti-gravity. You can make things appear to be weightless. Okay?
Oh, wow.
And if you do that, you can take a huge parcel of the atmosphere, make it weightless, so that it now becomes buoyant, so it floats to the top of the atmosphere. You create huge convection. You create violent thunderstorms. You create incredible sprites and all the stuff that occurs in the atmosphere at the very high levels between the atmosphere and space. You can do amazing things if you manipulate a technology which no one else is even aware that you can manipulate.
Okay, so if I do the investigation and do my homework on this, which I will, who would you approach about this if you wanted to get something started to say we don't agree with what's going on?
Well, I'd start by contacting Nick Begich.
What is his name?
Nick Begich. He wrote the book called Angels Don't Play This Harp. Pun. Look up, Google Angels Don't Play This Harp. That will show you Begich as the author. Track down his publisher. I think his own publishing company published those books, so that by connecting with the publishing company, you connect with Begich. And Nick doesn't hide. He actually responds very nicely to public inquiries. So, you know, talk to Nick Begich.
Well, thank you so much for all the information. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for calling in.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Okay, now, our next caller says he is Joe Schmo. Are you the famous Joe Schmo?
Hi, Richard.
Good morning.
No, that's just an alias.
Okay. So where do you want us to go this morning?
Okay, back in the late 80s, the early 90s, I had one of those big 12-foot wire mesh satellite dish antennas.
Oh, the old C-band.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, I was fooling around looking for something to watch one night, and I come across a show called E.T. Monitor with Robert Barry.
Oh, I remember that. Wasn't he in Alaska or something?
I think he was, like, in Pennsylvania, maybe.
I thought he was. Anyway, go ahead. Was he the guy that was showing all these shuttle videos?
Yeah, he was like a little old man, you know. Sweet little old guy.
Okay.
And he had on the show where he had the STS-48 videos.
Yes.
That's the ones where, you know, it's kind of like a night vision shot.
Well, it's low light level television in the payload bay of the shuttle. I picked up on STS-48. We did our first scientific analysis, and I put it at the end of a presentation I did at the UN, an additional 30-minute analysis of STS-48. And I came to the conclusion that, no, it was not UFOs. It was our secret space program. You know why I ultimately came to that conclusion?
Why is that?
The activity occurred at 19.5 over Australia.
Oh.
So what aliens would know the significance of 19.5 in a planetary terrestrial grid system?
Right.
And that was not the only occasion, by the way, where we saw very unusual activity at 19.5. The next occurrence of the shuttle video was a sequence showing something streaking up from Chile one night toward the shuttle. Very brilliant, very bright. And again, that activity occurred over 19.5 over South America.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, he got me thinking, you know, well, that was pretty interesting video, you know, whatever it was. And so I got the idea. I thought, well, you know, I got a VCR. So at that time, they had those VCR tapes that were, you could run them for 8 hours. You know, instead of the 6 hours normal, they had the extended tapes. And so I thought, well, you know, three of those a day, I could record all the whole mission. So this was in 93, and I just decided, you know, by then I was ready to go. And I started filming the STS-55 mission.
Okay.
And I started in the morning before I go to work, you know, come home, put in a blank one. And I did that for the whole mission, you know, because I'd bought a bunch of tapes.
Did you see anything?
Yeah. There's I think it's – I'm kind of confused whether it's day three or day two into day three, you know, because it's such a long time ago, you know. But anyway, it took me months to go through these tapes because, you know, I did it – I mean, I couldn't watch nothing on my satellite dish for that whole time. You know, I had to watch regular TV while these are recording.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just waited till I got the whole mission done and then went back, started watching them. And
so what did you see?
Huh?
What did you see?
Well, it starts out with, and the shuttle is flying backwards, you know, and the tail is kind of pointing down towards Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going from daylight into darkness, you know, the Terminator.
Across the Terminator, yes.
Yeah. And, you know, a guy comes on, he tells you what we're looking at, like there was a material exposure lid that was open, you know, and he was explaining that. And you can see the D2 module, you know, sitting in the cargo bay. And just as it's getting to darkness, you can see something kind of – the camera goes out of focus, and it's one of the cargo bay cameras too. It's not from inside the cabin to the outside, and you can see something blinking in the lower left, you know, like a light blinking, but it's the camera's out of focus. And then you see something on the right-hand side, and it's out of focus and starts blinking, and then all of a sudden, you know, they fill around with the camera, and it comes into focus, and I'm telling you, Richard, if there's any way you can get the video for STS-55, you need to do it, because this is color film, you know, view. It's not the low light stuff.
Can you transfer your tape to some kind of video, like upload to YouTube or send me a DVD or something?
Yeah, I've put it. I've since put it on DVD, and I could mail you one of those.
Yeah, why don't you do that? Okay, it's Enterprise Mission, P.O. Okay. Box 1041.
1041.
Placitas, P-L-A-C-I-T-A-S.
Wait a minute, you're going to have to slow down, P-L. I'm not very fast.
Placitas, P-L-A-C-I-T-A-S.
T-A-S.
Placitas, New Mexico,
87043.
That gets directly to us.
Well, I'll send you a copy of this in the... into your PO.
Excellent.
I think you'll be pretty impressed.
Well, see, that's the first step. When I look at it, if it's not something that I say, oh, that's a so-and-so, the next step is to go to Houston and get access to the original tapes.
Right. Well, this one, you know, there's one, I call it the mothership. There's actually two or three of them. But one comes from underneath the shuttle, and it's moving from right to left, and it stops. And then two small lights come out, and they're heading in the opposite direction that the shuttle's going. But there's at least 20, I would say, objects that are just, to me, they kind of defy explanation. I don't know if that altitude, if you can see airplanes
off. No. Not on those cameras. The resolution was too poor.
Okay. Well, they're approaching... the reason why I thought it was funny is they're approaching the coast of Chile. And that's when you said, you know, the thing about Chile, I thought, well, this will interest you then.
It might be. See, I don't remember all the mission numbers because there were, what, 25, 30 years of shuttle missions. So
yeah, and they didn't go in order either.
No. And it may be it's the same thing that I was talking about. If it is, I'll instantly know it when I see it.
Okay. Well, I've seen that, you know, I think it was Martin Stubbs or somebody, some guy in Canada that recorded a whole bunch of the missions and found all the stuff. And I've watched both of his DVDs and nothing on that about STS-55. I can't find nothing on YouTube about STS-55. So I don't know why this mission is not found in any of the UFO videos you can find anywhere.
Isn't that intriguing?
And it's the Germans, too, you know, the D2 lab experiment.
Well, that may explain it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, all right. Send that over, and I'll let you know what I think.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All righty.
Talk later.
Night. Okay. Let's see if we can add. Okay. You are on the air. Give us your name, where you're calling from.
Steve from Annapolis.
Steve? Annapolis?
Minneapolis. How you doing?
How you doing, Richard? I'm doing great. We've got about 2 minutes till the break. So, what do you want to hit us with?
I was wondering about everyone on YouTube was freaking out about tomorrow, September 23rd, 2015.
Tomorrow. Today is the 23rd, and it's the equinox.
The 23rd, and then.
And the Pope is here. Well, he's not exactly here. He's over in Washington, but he's in the country.
Yes, sir.
Did you hear last night's show?
Yes, with Georgia. Yes, I did.
So it's set up perfectly. Remember, he landed Greenwich Mean Time at exactly 19.5.
Yeah, that was kind of ridiculous.
Well, not if you're following a ritual which has the physics underneath as a hidden message. That the physics is what we're using to change the future.
Then I was wondering about the blood moon on the 28th.
That's just a name. Means nothing.
Is that nothing? Is that kind of Jewish?
It's a nothing. You know, there's blue moons, blood moons. The moon is the moon. The moon orbits around. Sometimes because of the way the calendars get out of sync, you get two full moons in the same month, barely. Sometimes you get an eclipse. But it's all just names. It's just, you know, it's just naming things. The physics of the moon going around the Earth does not change. Certainly over that tiny time span. Okay?
Thank you.
All righty. All right, folks, we're going to take a small hiatus. We're going to have one more song tonight by my friend Amanda, who really, really, really writes well. I love her stuff. I wish she would send us more. So you're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and you are on the other side of midnight. We shall return.
Barefoot in my sundress, your arms wrapped around me, and for a moment our past disappeared. But I heard the thunder, so I said, it's getting late. Instead of what you needed to hear, blaming the rain, like yelling at a ghost, like the call that doesn't come, and then cursing the phone, like punching the wall. Oh, but I'm the one that bleeds. It's like the nothing I can do to bring you back to me, and putting it all on you for leaving me this way. It's like blaming the rain.
And we are back. Lewis, you're on the air. Good morning.
Richard Hoagland. This is Open Hailing Lines, right?
Open Frequencies.
It's very hard to get through to you this evening, by the way. Very hard.
Because there's lots of people trying to get through to us.
A couple things, they won't take long. I think Iron Mountain requires more than one show, more than 2 hours. If I may say so.
Oh, I totally agree. We got to start somewhere. I mean, we started with half an hour with Robin. We're going to then do it 2 hours. When we get to 3 hours, we'll do a 3-hour show. There's all different kinds of angles. I need to find more people from the inside who actually will now fess up, given that this has become, you know, officially declassified by the president, that, yeah, this was our idea. This is how it was hijacked. This is where they took it. This is, in other words, that's all yet to be done.
I'm reading it, just so you know. But I want to point out that October 1, 1967 was a Sunday, just so you know, at least on the calendar I looked at online.
And you don't think the president has a briefing on a Sunday?
That's what I'm throwing out there. I don't know.
Of course he did.
Well, just make sure. That's all. You know, I'll point that out.
Other Sundays are in the calendar.
Are they?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Not being argumentative.
You really think that the president of the United States takes Sunday off?
Well, any given Sunday, who knows? Maybe he went to, well, anyway.
Remember, 1967, we were at the height of the Cold War.
And actually, yeah, when was the Six-Day War? What months were those?
That was not shortly thereafter. So, yeah, it wasn't a peaceful time. Johnson did not, you know, because we were up to our eyebrows bombing the hell out of Vietnam.
Oh, I know that.
So,
yeah.
Obviously, he had a briefing, and obviously, they didn't want us to see what they said about Iron Mountain in the briefing.
It's a pretty interesting document, I'll tell you. Lots of buried nuggets in there. The last thing I'll mention, and I'm glad I was able to get through. I guess this tells you what your show's, what is your show becoming very popular. But remember, we had talked about cutting benefits for the disabled. I'm hoping you'll bring that up again.
Run that by me again.
Remember, several callers called in about the disabled having their benefits.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I just didn't want to let that drop either. Like, I don't want Iron Mountain to.
No, I got your email on that, and we're looking into doing something that will handle that appropriately.
Okay. Well, thank you for your time, Mr. Olin.
No problem.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Okay. Numbers 505-796-8802. 796-8802. I mean, now, of course, everybody's waiting to see what's going to happen so you could get through. Skype name, Enterprise Mission. Enterprise Mission, indeed. Yeah, Iron Mountain is a very complicated can of worms that we are going to unpack very carefully and slowly and look at all the, as Lewis said, there are gems hidden in the document that when you read it, if you don't read it carefully, if you don't pay attention very carefully to the structure and to the various experts they brought in and to their various scenarios, you're going to miss some things. So you go to the top of the website for last night. Was it last night? No, it was a couple nights ago. Just look through back shows. You'll see it. Iron Mountain, report from Iron Mountain at the very top of the guest page. Click on that. That takes you to the entire book, the entire document. And I suggest that you do it because it's important. Okay, who are you and where are you calling from?
My name is Dre, and I'm...
Gray or Greg?
Dre.
Gray?
And, Dre, as in, like, Dre.
Like D-R-E. Like the color gray?
No, like Andre. Dre.
Oh. Okay, and Dre, okay.
Yeah, Dre, just call me Dre. Anyways, how are you this evening? Or morning, I'm,
one does not know, does one? And where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Canada.
Canada, ah.
Yes, sir.
You know that we actually lost a presidential candidate the other day who suggested building a wall between you guys and us guys?
Walls? I'm aided with that.
Governor Walker, remember him? Oh, we should build a wall between us and Canada. I mean, this really is strange politics, strange politics. So what did you want to talk about?
Okay, well, I don't know. I had called in yesterday and at our Bell's show, and he had an NDE show on, and I called in and gave a scenario of NDE experiment that I had done with two different anesthetics. That's not why I'm calling tonight. I was very frazzled yesterday because in the last week I almost got into a really serious car accident, and I avoided it. And so I was very frazzled. So I am very different state altogether.
Well, obviously you're here for a reason.
Yeah, and the reason is you're talking about, some of your callers were talking about chemtrails.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not calling to speak about chemtrails, but to pose this one theory that I may have. You are familiar with orbitally rearranged monoatomic elements.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Monatomic gold, et cetera, Hudson's work, all that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I was wondering, could that play a part in a substitution for what they're doing with the barium and other alloys and whatever the cocktail that they're putting up there? And because that in itself, because I've experimented with it, and it's etheric and definitely torsion related in some ways, and I don't know if you'd agree with me, but that's my question for you.
Well, but I'm not the right guy to ask the question of, because I'm not the one running the experiments. You know, you have to ask the question of the guys that are actually doing this and ask them why they're doing it. We're trying to infer what they're doing from the outside. What we need is somebody on the inside saying, this is why we load these chemicals, this is why we inject them at 40,000 feet, this is the overall game plan, this is our, excuse me, this is our routing, you know, so we get global coverage and all that. We have none of that data yet.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. And that data isn't being released to us for, I don't know, peculiar reasons, but it should be.
Well, no, it's not peculiar. Look. If the guys in charge, the guys on the inside, mainstream people, you know, look at the temperature curves and look at what we're doing to the planet and looking at the natural physics, which is adding to the heat burden of the Earth, and they feel they cannot tell us what's really going on for a variety of reasons, and they want to secretly try to turn down the thermostat without letting us know how bad it could get, because if they tell us how bad it gets, society collapses, billions of people die, and we have to start over. So if this is a secret program to solve a problem without letting us all know there's a problem, and the problem is global weather modification, climate modification, cooling the upper atmosphere to prevent the Earth's atmosphere from topping out and, you know, turning over like Venus did, then I can see a logic to their logic. I don't agree with it. I think we should know, because there are all kinds of other technologies we could be using to substitute for fossil fuels. Oh, but wait a minute. That wouldn't make oil companies billions and billions and billions of dollars. So that's the catch-22. They can't tell us the truth, because if they told us the truth, we wouldn't continue the same economic system that is part of them not telling us the truth.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just, I think that our planet deserves a little bit better metal.
And so do we.
Made of metal. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, that was just my question, and maybe another time can maybe elaborate on it a bit more or something.
Well, we'll actually have some folks on to talk about, you know, chemtrails with some expertise, and I'm going to track down Will Thomas and see what he's doing these days. Remember, I've had this show only for a couple of months, and we're just kind of getting our sea legs, as my dad used to say, so give us a little time, and we'll add these people to the list, and we'll ask them the appropriate questions.
Just before you let me go, one other person that you might want to research that is a monoatomic alchemist is an individual named Don Guilford with Blue Water Alchemy.
Don Guilford, Blue Water Alchemy.
You should put him on your show.
Okay. Ross, I hope you're taking notes. Ross is our producer.
Okay.
Good suggestion.
Okay, take care and have a nice morning. I should say evening again, but have a nice morning.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, give us your name and where you're calling from. Hello? Did we lose him? I guess we lost him. Okay, let's take this call. Who are you and where are you calling from?
Hi, Richard. This is Kevin here in Colorado Springs.
Oh, Kevin. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning. Hey, I just wanted to comment because it's been bugging me ever since Art did his show last night.
What did he do? He seems to have ruffled a lot of feathers.
No, he didn't ruffle my feathers.
Okay.
But the number of people that called in complaining that this scientist that Art talked to was either falsifying, making up, or otherwise denying the truth that their truth that there is no global warming.
Wait, stop you there.
Yeah, that was
Art had an expert on who is claiming there is no global warming.
No, that there is global warming.
Okay,
and some of these people that were calling. We're just land. You don't know what you're talking about. There is no global warming, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, they have an opinion.
Yes.
Do they have facts?
Exactly.
So why would you get upset about that?
Because it occurred to me, you had a call on the other night, Torch, I think it was. It was a caller about the asteroid coming in today. There's no evidence at all, nothing, period, that says an asteroid is coming in and we would see evidence of it long before it got here. And there are people that are going, evacuating, hiding out in the mountains because of the supposed asteroid.
Mm-hmm.
Those same people are the ones who would deny the science of global warming.
Well, some of them, maybe.
Well, a lot of them. That's what.
Well, hang on. We don't know because we haven't done a survey. Let's assume that some of them. Look, bottom line in all this, there is so much fear porn being deliberately spread across the internet to create this inchoate mass of fear, this huge, squirming, slimy ball of fear. That's supposed to take our consciousness and take our attention and take our preoccupations and totally mesmerize us so that we don't pay attention to all the extraordinarily good things that are happening. The way you control people is you make them terrified and then they don't ask how high when you tell them to jump.
Well, that's kind of what I was getting to with that, because you can quote chapter and verse of science on a lot of things. And for some reason, if people are locked into opinion, no matter how much science you have on your side, they want to deny it. And it's an interesting thing to me, the psychology of that, because it doesn't just happen with global warming. You've talked about the science of Planet X,
mm-hmm.
the fact that we, you know, you would see it in the sky if you just took a telescope and looked for it.
There'd be all kinds of ways to see it years before it got here.
Oh, well, just from the gravitational effect
mm-hmm.
alone.
Yes, yes.
And
I mean, don't you think amateur astronomers, if planetary movements were being jiggled and things were no longer where the computer model said they should be, wouldn't you think that an awful lot of amateur astronomers looking up, not being able to find stuff, would get very upset and through social media would let the world know instantly that things are not where they should be? So you can't hide these cosmic phenomena. And that's why you've got to look beyond sourcing just on the web, because the web, remember, I said on our show decades ago, on the internet, no one knows you're a dog.
That's true, and that's another interesting psychological phenomenon for me, is the fact that we have this great invention called the World Wide Web that can give you information at the click of a button.
Mm-hmm. We're using it tonight. This show would not exist without the internet.
Right. But people do not want to take the time to look up real information.
Some people.
As opposed,
some
you
people.
You know, I'm being general, yes. Mm. But
remember, it only takes 2% to change the world. If 98% are too lazy to do anything, the 2% that aren't will change the world. That's what's going on in this election. All the activists on both polarities, you know, the left and the right, are taking the bit by, you know, in their teeth, and they're moving in directions that the sanctioned mainstream is freaking out about because they've fed up, they've had it, they want their government back. And what's interesting is to see the two radically different solutions to the same sets of problems represented by Bernie Sanders on the one hand and Donald Trump on the other.
And I know you've kind of made a model of a prediction there, but I've got two real quick questions for you.
Okay.
Richard, I agree with what you and Lou were talking about with the report from Iron Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
But where was Iron Mountain at? Was that the one in Birmingham, Alabama?
No.
Was that a different Iron Mountain?
No. The Iron Mountain is an aphorism for a think tank that was located, I believe, in upstate New York.
I've always wondered about that, and because I'm blind, I've heard it bandied about, but I never have seen anything about where it actually was. And then my second question, if you had to give me a thumbnail description of the torsion field to someone that didn't know anything about it at all,
mm-hmm.
how would you describe it to them?
Hmm. Okay. Are you familiar with the old concept of the ether?
Right, yeah. I understand what it is. I just would like the way of explaining it.
Well, remember, you can only know something by its effects. Intrinsically, the only way we know anything is by the effects that thing produces on other things that we are watching or observing or measuring. So the way you measure the torsion field, according to Kozyrev, who was the Soviet astronomer who first actually did experiments, to my knowledge, modern experiments that reveal that there was this invisible matrix in which our reality functions, is he noticed that strange phenomenon occurred when he would melt ice in a glass, and he had a big torsion beam. You know what a torsion beam is? It's kind of like a teeter-totter, except instead of going up and down, it moves left and right.
Left and right, yeah.
And it's sitting on a very frictionless pivot, so a very, very tiny force will cause it to rotate slowly, either left or right. He had this torsion beam set up in a bell jar, which was partially evacuated, so it was a semi-vacuum. So it was separated from the lab. And he would perform these experiments in various locations in the lab, and when he would change the phase state of like water, like melting ice is changing the phase from ice to water, the torsion beam would rotate so that the center of it, the part that had a needle that was kind of giving him the alignment, would focus on the experiment where ice was melting into water. Now, nothing in the electromagnetic spectrum, nothing in known physics, nothing in any science that he knew could account for a connection between melting ice and a force that could rotate a slowly rotatable mass in three dimensions to rotate until it was facing it. That's where he coined the idea of a torsion field, because torsion means to rotate. We get the word torque. All right, so torsion means rotation. So in the ether, it turns out, according to Kozarev and other experiments, there are not like longitudinal waves or transverse waves. There are vorticular waves that rotate through the ether. That's why rotating things, like my little Accutron tuning fork, are so sensitive to changes in the field, because a dynamically moving system is actually in partial rotation, and it's the rotation which connects in resonance and allows instrumentation in our 3D reality to actually monitor changes in the otherwise invisible ether / torsion field.
Well, that sounds like a good way to describe it. I've been struggling with a way to describe it to someone, and that kind of works.
Think of it as a room filled with smoke rings that you can't see.
Well, I was thinking
of all different sizes and scales, from really tiny ones to really huge ones.
We know there's atoms and molecules. We can't see them with the naked eye, but we know they're there.
And the way you know that is because they produce motion effects, change effects on objects that we are observing.
So that leads to the question of why would you deny the torsion field if you know that there are molecules and atoms? Then could there not be a torsion field as you just explained?
Well, remember, a theory is one thing, but actual experimental observations, empirical observations, are the important correlative. Right. You know, observation precedes theory. In other words, whatever does not agree with observation has to be changed. If the theory doesn't agree with the observations, the theory is wrong and it must be changed.
Yep, I agree. Oh, just one thing. Have you ever been here to Colorado Springs?
Once.
I was just wondering what would happen if you possibly measured the torsion field for Tesla. This is experiment.
You mean up on Pikes Peak?
Yep.
I'd love to do that. I mean, is it not possible that there's a reason why Cheyenne Mountain and NORAD was placed there in terms of torsion physics reasons? Remember, they hollowed out a whole mountain to put the NORAD inside in Colorado Springs, just a stone's throw from Pikes Peak.
Yeah, well,
someday I've got to come up and measure.
Yep.
Okay?
Okay, thank you, Richard. Appreciate
Thanks, Kevin.
It.
Later.
Bye-bye.
Okay, you are on the air. Give us your name, where you're calling from.
This is Jared from Fort Collins, Colorado.
Jared?
Yes, sir.
Oh, nice name, Jared. Jared, I used to know some folks in Fort Collins.
Very nice.
It's a beautiful place,
yes. You make your way up here sometime soon. I'd really enjoy
this. This was many years ago, many years ago. So why are you calling tonight?
I just kind of wanted to comment on what Kevin was saying a little bit as to Art Bell's conversation. And what I was going across in my mind was that as he was saying that, I was kind of reading some feeds off the Twitter, too. And it seems to me like there's a lot of people that want to put input. And I think, you know, I'm thinking Koch brothers type stuff where they're so infiltrating even like this show. So they're giving their opinions of this anti, you know, global warming, whatever you want to say. And I think it's like, it's like more dense information. I think it's part of the social engineering that you were getting at. And I also think that, you know, what you were saying with the aluminum and the chemtrails, I think directly feeds into this. And so I think it just comes full circle and points right back into that, you know, shadow of, you know, kind of conspiracy. I don't know if it's so much that, but I just definitely think there's an energy that's coming out, especially with this political season, given the way that it is, you know. It seems that, like, even in the smallest fields, they're able to interject their opinions,
mm-hmm.
and thus that, you know, causes us to go head.
Opinions, I mean, that's what the First Amendment's all about. We're supposed to interject opinions.
Yeah, you know, I definitely agree with you there, but I don't think that opinion should be used in turn to so much, you know, just disrupt, because here we are on, you know, we're trying to escape the mainstream media, get to your points, and, you know, and it just feels like we're getting some outside interference. So if anything, I think your work is, you know, saying that people are standing up and taking notice in other, you know, circles. Besides our, you know, alternative listening circles here. And I do agree with the opinions. I just don't like having opinions so forcibly objected to me, and especially when it's coming in from an outside influence.
Now, you're not talking about people calling into this show. You're talking about them calling into art?
Well, yeah, and it's just even on the Twitter feeds, like, you just have people, and they're on there all the time. I myself just, I don't do it, but I actually read it. But it's like you have your normal people going along doing their things, and then there was a guy tonight that was from New Hampshire Tea Party or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's just like they're expressing more of an opinion for a political party more than a personal person. So it seems to me like, you know, and I hate to think this, but I think that someone's sitting around getting paid to listen to these shows, call in, and, you know, just basically stir up it.
Mm-hmm.
Stir it up. So it's not so much of a matter of opinion, but more or less of a cause and effect.
But as you have just noted, it's kind of obvious when that's going on, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So?
And that's just kind of what I was thinking with Kevin, that I don't think it was so much the callers. I actually think it was, you know, some outside forces that were like, hey, let's stir the pot here, you know?
Hey,
the good old-fashioned.
You know what? You know what time it is? It's the end of the
show.
It's the time to go. Yes. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
I'm so glad I got it at the last moment.
Okay.
And I thank you so much for your work. I've read most of your books, and just continue on.
Thank you. And that's another wrap on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. Remember, until tomorrow morning, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night.